Dominique Behig will present the first one, which is co-authored, and it's called The Rise of Cost-Effectiveness Evidence in Global Health, Contingencies of Context and the Politics of Contingency.
Thank you, and thank you to the organizers for this. It's been a great couple of days. And it's a shame that my co-author, Katerini Storin, was not able to come here, but I just wanted to correct in the program. She's not actually from Vanderbilt or King's. She's based in Norway now. She was my doctoral student at the LSHTM, where we worked together then for many years. So very interesting work that she's also doing on vaccination and vaccine. But this is then a paper that we're sort of really working through at the moment. It comes from a larger project looking at evidence-based medicine and how it has diffused into various arenas, evidence-based policymaking, and the reactions to the evidence-based medicine movement more generally, including resistance reactions, really. So this is, and we've taken maternal health as a case study, but we're looking to expand this into other areas, so feedback is very welcome. One area is where so-called epistemic resistance has emerged is with relation to the concept of context, where these debates are really coming to the fore. And we see so-called resistance emerging from within normative or conventional epidemiological and public health science, obviously from the social sciences and anthropology, and from the so-called global south. Now, just a little bit about safe motherhood before going into this interface of normative and marginal epistemologies as it relates to context. The Safe Motherhood Initiative was born out of a strategic break from child health. For many of you who know the history of public health, it used to be MCH, maternal and child health. And there was a concern that child health was sort of overshadowing maternal mortality, which is basically death in childbirth. Now, since the 1970s, WHO has been putting a lot of money into TBA training, so the TBAs have really played an important role for many decades. But when Safe Motherhood was launched in 1987, there was kind of a lot of writing in journals typifying what we call a kind of a narrative of failure with regards to both the lack of reduction in maternal mortality in various countries where TBA investment had been high, but also a lack of failure on the part of SMI experts to call attention to this problem. And political scientists who study this call these coalitions advocacy coalitions, effectively, because part of their remit, a major part of their remit, is to keep an issue on the agenda, on the international agenda. So the narrative of failure was really put forth in various editorials. And part of that narrative then was a call for more evidence-based medicine or evidence-based policymaking as kind of a strategic attempt to produce evidence that would call attention to the donors, to national governments, to the international community more generally. At the same time, Safe Motherhood is perhaps unique, we're not quite sure because we haven't done ethnography in other areas, in the sense that it has always recognized from the very beginning the complexity of maternal mortality reduction. Unlike child health, which has many interventions which can be delivered by community healthcare workers, it is very hard to predict complications which will lead to death in childbirth. And so basically what you need is a very well-functioning health system that's able to refer at the very moment that there is an alarm. So you really need a three-tiered health system, emergency obstetric care. So there's been this, in terms of epistemic orientations, this kind of vacillation between these more technocratic approaches, let's just go in and, you know, train TBAs or get people quick access to EMOC, emergency obstetric care, and also a very strong concern with social justice and kind of a vacillation between these two. It's probably not coincidental that the SMI is led by demographers and epidemiologists, many of whom have kind of a history of feminist inclinations, and who have therefore created allegiances and alliances with anthropologists. And in fact, some of the leaders are anthropologists themselves. So I would say that they are relatively epistemologically daring. Now, this is just to give you a sense of our fieldwork and to highlight that we really tried as best as possible to focus on participant observation, and I'll talk a little bit more about why. I mean, I know we all do, but I think it's a point to underscore, and also just to give a sense of the range of kind of informants that we tried to talk to, all in different levels and in the so-called global arenas and national arenas. So in terms of the results, I'll just present it in two parts. First, I'll do a kind of a substantive review of what the problem of context really is, and I'll go through that very quickly because I think that will be very recognizable to most of you. So what are these knowledge policy debates? I'll question whether maybe the problem of context as it emerges as a counterpoint to problems of standardization and universality or generalizability might not be caught in what we call provisionally in epistemic gridlock. I'll then go and speak about the politics of context, and here we're playing around with some different framings, thinking about how debates around context are very much part of a politics of self-governance on the part of the experts themselves, where they are using both the notion of culture as a resource, but also the critique of culturalism, and here referred to Fassin, as part of this mechanism of self-governance. And this led us to think, we're thinking through a little bit how the trope of complexity, which Moll and Law have discussed, plays into this, the trope of complexity being this kind of assumption that anything which has a singularizing narrative, a universalizing narrative, inherently produces kind of a violence. So again, how does that trope of complexity play into these politics of self-governance? And again, we're just making a shift that, you know, we've heard about very much these past few days between an analysis of representation, an analysis of discourse as it is represented in text and perhaps even interviews, versus an analysis of what happens when you really focus on enactment of these experts. And, you know, maybe thinking about how we might not, perhaps if we don't make that shift, we are certainly making assumptions that these actors are rational actors. There's been a lot about the assumption of rationality in anthropology, and I think we sort of need to apply that to the world of expertise as well. So for the problem of context, what is it? So we start with this organizational starting point, epistemic standardization. We all know this very well. In safe motherhood, like any other subfield, these packages that WHO puts forth on strategies are produced, are very much based nowadays on the Cochrane Library, the Cochrane Collaboration, and this hierarchy of evidence where you really need to go for RCT-type data in order to be able to say something conclusive about which strategy you're going to go for. So again, just to highlight here, we're not talking about clinical interventions, we're talking about strategies. Do we go with TBAs or do we go with strategies to uptake emergency obstetric care? That's one of the key questions that these people are working towards. Now, of course, context creeps in where this starting point immediately starts to break down. And within mainstream global health science, we see this in various ways, a shift from efficacy trials, which is much more laboratory oriented, to so-called effectiveness trials, which tries to replicate RCTs in that so-called more natural settings. An interesting demand to increasingly replicate trials which are so-called complex or social or cultural before definitive generalizability can be concluded. So a greater demand for replicability, which creates all sorts of issues. A whole body of literature now and research on scaling up and implementations called operations research, which has nothing to do really with the Cochrane hierarchy. Lots of debates on the loss of variability as a problem-solving and analytical resource when you do impose this unifying model. And we see these kinds of headlines, evidence-based public health, moving beyond randomized controlled trials, publications from very prominent epidemiologists. So here's one who self-identifies as an ex-trialist talking about, you know, this isn't working, we're losing variation, we're losing ability to analyze. Another one who says, you know, you just simply can't act like sub-Saharan Africa as a homogeneous whole, it's arrogant. But on the other hand, how much do we need to replicate before we can tell WHO go for it? I mean, it can get quite ludicrous to think of doing the same trial 52 times in order to have generalizability. And of course, from the more radical margins and other disciplines, we have questioning around what's the point of distilling so much that you come up with such an abstract policy recommendation that can't actually be applied. This argument that global dictates, like WHO documents, really straitjacket local problem solving and attention to context, and a lot of reflexivity around, we made a mistake thinking that there was a gold standard. We're certainly not going to move the agenda forward this way. The whole issue of alienation of TBAs and lack of cultural competency, which anthropologists have really fed into, done a lot of work on what happens when we shifted away from TBA training towards health system strengthening and emergency obstetric care. Here, a health economist saying how the World Bank diagrams are just ridiculous. So this is just to demonstrate that there is a lot of reflexivity, and we're moving into what some of our interlocutors talked to informally about, the phase two of the Cochrane mission, which is this formal recognition of the epistemological limitations of the RCT and the call for multidisciplinary perspectives in which anthropology is starting to play an increasingly important role. Now, anthropologists who have been analyzing this process have sort of analyze it as a process, almost like an ideological process, arguing that the Cochrane is open to these critiques and is subsuming them, is incorporating them as a way of sort of dominating and moving on with the original main agenda. And it's a very persuasive analysis, but I think perhaps a little bit limited. I do think there is genuine epistemological diversity being injected into the system, and I think it's important to question why, how that functions, what's it doing. So that's where we get to the issue of the politics of context. And as we think this through then, we're trying to think about these epistemic shifts in ways of reasoning and shifting from that focus to the socialization of diverse epistemic positions, how people get socialized in this way, in diverse ways of thinking, to the social and political life of these epistemic positions. So taking that as our object, the epistemic position itself, to the specific contingent moments in which these positions are enacted and become salient and hold value or lose value. And this is really what we were trying to get at when we used this terrible subtitle of ours that I now regret. And I think the first thing that comes to light when you look at enactment, when you look at these specific contingent moments, is the fact that there is actually very little epistemological stability amongst our interlocutors. Of the 100 so people, I would say maybe 2 or 3 are ardent, you know, ardently hold on to one or other or epistemological position. That might seem obvious to you, but it was a revelation to us. So how does the politics work out then? In terms of global expertise, there is this real recognition, and again, here we're moving also, I should say, from kind of the public domain to the private domain as well, of expert and expertise, not just to enactment, and to maybe generalizability and specificity as well. So a recognition of the political salience of scientifically justified homogeneity and sort of the denial of context. And this we've written about this, in a paper that will come out soon, in a sense that evidence-based medicine has kind of been cynically recoined, and again, this is all in backdoor conversations in hallways, as evidence-based advocacy. And this relates to, you know, Vin Kim's comment, why are we, this question is why are we doing RCTs in some contexts? So here we have someone who's saying, I was determined to have hard health outcomes. That's the way you get the attention of the big people, of the big bank. And a recognition that some of the questions that are being answered then are strategic rather than epistemologically persuasive. Policymakers and donors are always looking at free things that you can do. If you put the complexity argument out there, effectively they will, it just looks too complex, and they throw their hands up and walk away. So there's this strong sense of, at the same time, an epistemological and moral discomfort with this position. So what we found is that people were in their careers, you know, getting the big Lancet articles based on their RCTs and kind of on the side doing the kind of epistemological work that they found persuasive is important, that was really answering the questions that they were interested in. So there's this kind of balancing effect of balancing the risks and benefits of engaging in evidence-based advocacy effectively. At the same time, a strong sense of discomfort with this. So I'll read this one in full because I think it's very useful. It's a senior epidemiologist in the SMI. I'm so convinced of the argument to shift away from TBAs, not alienate them, but to shift away from TBAs towards health system strengthening. But what makes the policymakers shift? Do we need another beautiful trial showing that TBAs make no difference? And it's strategically impossible to do a trial on whether TBAs make a difference or not, really. I hope not. It's not whether in the perfect circumstances you can train TBAs and supervise them. Of course, that will make a difference. But then you're talking about an expensive system anyway, and you might as well train skilled providers. Quite a few people are calling for trials of community health workers, and the donors are taking note. If we've gone that far, well, what a waste of money. But maybe we have to play the game. I don't know. So there's this compromise between what we've talked about in another publication, a kind of pragmatic EB politics alongside these epistemological innovations. And I'll just talk briefly about one of those. So some of these demographers and epidemiologists have recently turned to history of public health decline, maternal mortality decline in the 19th century in Europe and the 20th century in other middle-income countries, to sort of glean what can account for maternal mortality decline. And not surprisingly, they have found, using trend data, policy analysis, a bit of qualitative analysis, that it is a synergy between technical and political factors. So there are issues like control of sepsis on the play, but also governments commitment to equity, social justice, and health systems. So there's an interesting case of Sweden, which keeps getting repeated in the literature. So that's one example of epistemological innovation. And effectively, then, what we're saying here is that people are leading, these experts are leading multiple epistemic lives, some more strategic than others, depending on the audience, the strategy, their personal interests, but also their assessed risks to their career. And so some, you know, the subtext here was, again, in the early part of your career, get yourself established. It's something that you have to do for the sake of the SMI advocacy coalition, existing through time, and then get to the questions that actually need answering. Again, still in the global arena, if we look at our interlocutor's own sort of what you could consider para-ethnographic observations, we see a concern that the internally generated, through this narrative of failure, the internally generated demand for evidence-based advocacy has backfired. So some people saying we sort of killed ourselves by arguing that you need trial evidence. What are we going to do now? A recognition that other, or an observation that other sub-strong fields, like HIV is always posited as the most successful advocacy coalition, do not actually have top quality RCT evidence, and nor do they necessarily marginalize the importance of context and necessarily push for universalizing recommendations. And again, here we see the feminist inclinations, what they have, according to their observations, is the fact that the coalition was led by men in a very strong country, the US. So I think the demand for data quality is different in maternal health. It's because, you know, and sometimes, you know, we did interview people from outside of maternal health, and they were effectively depicted as just a bunch of ideological feminists. So that played against them, and I think that also played in favor of their own narrative of failure and their own call for stronger evidence-based policy. So we should stop complaining about our own evidence, because look at HIV, you know, their evidence isn't all that great. Our own observation that arguments in favor of either generalizability, either of replicating trials and doing more trials, or of context are used strategically by competitors within the field. For example, the field is, there's a big rift between those who want to promote TBAs, continue promoting TBAs and community-based interventions, and those who want to promote EMOC. So in various instances, for example, there is currently a trial that has been conducted in Malawi by actually a child, originally in Nepal, by a child health expert, that showed that women's groups, just women's empowerment groups, could reduce maternal mortality with the involvement of TBAs as well. And this group, you know, the people in the Safe Motherhood Initiative who were supporting health system strengthening and obstetric care were in alarm, because this was basically negating 20 years of their work of pushing for health systems. So there they use the argument of this particular trial needs to be replicated multiple times because this is a cultural intervention in order to marginalize it. At the same time, they were quick to accept trend data showing that TBAs have made no difference. So you see these arguments being used in very different ways and, again, very little epistemological consistency. So this raises the question of who or what is actually driving the demand for both this gold standard evidence and the use of context or evidence around context as a counterpoint. And obviously, it is partially donors, governments, accountability mechanisms, competition, and epistemic values. But this is where we're trying to rethink this a little bit in terms of also the self-governing tactics of expert groups. If we look at then the relationship between the so-called North and South, amongst some of our northern sort of informants based in big institutions, there was a recognition that places like WHO are oversimplifying, perhaps inappropriately, because of two main reasons. One, lack of local capacity for context-specific research, and again, this is very subtext, a kind of notion that the use of context and the use of anthropology is being used by nationals as a kind of post-colonial move to be able to justify their rejection of global dictates. And the Southern response, so to speak, I put that very much in quotes, is really to borrow epistemologically from ethnography in this negotiation and to use context. So here's just one example. This woman continued with TBA strategies, although she says, I know studies show that it doesn't really make a difference anyway, but it's kind of intuitive, don't you think? It's cultural, you know, it makes sense. So appealing to other forms of knowledge in this counterposition. And of course, in appealing to ethnography to make this context argument, and putting statements like that, interlocutors are referring to much more than, I think, just the importance of context. Yeah, that's fine. So what is this much more? They're calling attention to the fact that often evidence comes after the fact, after policies at the global level are already decided upon. So it's actually not informing in any particular way. I will pass through that. They are calling attention to the fact, I think this is quite interesting, that there are actually two types of context here at play. One which uses culture, and this relates to the culturalism argument, to operationalize the next best potential option. So TBAs is kind of seen as a techno fix that benefits the North, versus what some are calling really homegrown empowerment. And here it's very interesting that some are saying, you know, the funds that are currently going to large RCTs really would be better invested in institution building and surveillance data. And this is a very different kind of use of surveillance data. And in fact, the historical case studies that I referred to before in terms of Sweden being this excellent case study, 19th century Sweden, of the reduction of maternal mortality, really demonstrates how surveillance data can be used in a very empowering way. And this is what they're referring to. So not surveillance as in surveillance, but surveillance as in identifying problems in a way that that can be locally problem solved. So what they're questioning really here is what model for development, what type of government, how much neoliberalism is really acceptable. I'll just give you an example here. If even the local NGOs, which are seen as sort of the repository of institutions that can still be political, don't feel empowered to tackle these issues and keep doing things like teaching women to crochet laced oil leaves or whatever as part of an empowerment thing, you know, the AKA culture, that's not a very threatening thing to do. But if you're organizing women to go pick at the hospital, then that becomes much more political. But even the NGOs can't really do that. Other people really calling attention to the fact that those who are putting forth these magical diagrams, which seem, you know, somewhat unrealistic, are not addressing the gap between these guidelines and local realities, in large part because it's structural issues that need to be addressed, and it's the very people who are producing those magical evidence-based diagrams which have been imposing things like structural adjustment over the past decades. So, you know, really start, this is where the hardcore political arguments start to come out and where context gets used as a vehicle for that kind of discussion. This is my last empirical slide, where this effectively, what's happening here is, is a polarization between context as culture versus context as politics, and this is getting reproduced then in these global expert debates and competitions. So we see here the child health experts, the trial on women's empowerment, for example, which are now seen as a threat, a major threat to these SMI, and I'm typifying here, sorry, feminist experts, using context in a definition, in a way to sort of overcome culture, so very much in the critique of culturalism. So this women's empowerment trial that I mentioned earlier is actually being replicated beyond the call of duty, normal call of duty, in various sites. And the main aim, I think, when I spoke to the leaders of this trial, I think is really to achieve local buy-in and to get back to that generalizability starting point. And I'm just going to give you a quote here. I disagree that it would be difficult to change culture. It would be very different in a new context, but I don't know. When we went to country X, a senior doctor told us that wouldn't work here. Again, I think the subtext there is post-colonial rejection. I'm now throwing out the $100 challenge, which is if anyone can show me a culture where women do not enjoy getting together in a group and talking about small things. So here, very reduced definition of culture, and he's on this mission. And effectively, that trial was replicated in country X, and it showed no effect. SMI experts on context, on the contrast, are really trying to critique that notion of context as culture and put out one of context as politics. And here's an interesting critique that they're putting forth, which is a critique of the anthropological, what they call the anthropological nostalgia for TBA and for this sort of natural birth movement, which has been feeding into this polarization between TBAs and emergency obstetric care for now 3 decades. And effectively, they're also trying to indirectly critique the cost-effectiveness model of development. Again, a hard thing to imagine when they are themselves partaking in cost-effectiveness trials. I don't know if I should do many reflections. I think I'm probably way over time. Or do I have 30 seconds?
You're on the cusp of being over time.
Okay, so I'll just have 30 seconds. I'm not sure where to go with reflections, but I'll just say this. It's very difficult to not be persuaded by the SMI, to maintain a sort of neutral perspective, ethnographic perspective, to not be persuaded by these feminist, so-called feminist SMI experts. But I think it's interesting that in positing context as politics, they're arguing obviously for the importance of governance, of equity, of politics, of social justice. And in some ways, it is a universalizing discourse that they're putting out there. The evidence, and I didn't have time to go into it, that they're drawing from, the case study evidence of countries that have succeeded, does give us some lessons learned that make you wonder about how well they can be applied in different countries. It's a strong political argument. So I do wonder whether the question is not whether there are global commonalities. Of course there are, I think, if only by virtue of the fact that we are creating them at the same time that localisms are also multiplying. So I wonder whether it's not whether we can assume some level of generalizability, perhaps even universality when it comes to strategic change, but rather at what level and for what purpose, and along with this, a critical contestation of this trope of context, of complexity, I think is really at stake.